Well, I was going to thank Ted for his introduction. And Raul, where is he? Ted, thank you very much, and for starting on a light note. Yes, Raul gave me back that picture, and I thought those were the sole surviving copies. So as long as it's not posted online somewhere. I have no Facebook page. I have nothing to hide. Okay, anyway. So thanks, Ted, for your introduction. I've had great mentorship from Ted and Isaac Held and others, and I really have to say something about this department before I start, because we've had some colloquium speakers come here and say kind of negative things, and this department is really unique in its support of earth sciences and its support of climate science, and I just want to acknowledge that this is the kind of research I do in this in a physics department is truly, it's a truly unique position I'm in to have to work with people and to be surrounded by students who know so much about the numerate side of the climate system, about the mathematical analysis, and aren't afraid of that kind of work. So in that spirit, I wanted to start the colloquium with kind of a couple of highlight slides that are more about the climate problem generally, but they won't actually be the focus of the talk. The focus of the talk will be more on quantifying the way the climate responds to climate to human influence. But I think it's important to talk about the stakes a little bit, and this graphic really highlights the stakes of what's involved in understanding climate change. And it shows the a quantity called the Arctic sea ice extent, the minimum sea ice extent. So every year, since satellite observations began, we've been tracking the extent that the Arctic sea ice goes out into the ocean, taking an aerial average, measure of that in millions of square kilometers, and this goes from the late 70s into 2000. You can see there's been this overall trend of a decline, including in 2007 a very strong drop, which was very well publicized. 2008, 2009 have shown some recovery, not to previous values, certainly not to the mean, but to the long-term trend line. And there are fluctuations in this quantity. They go up and down. I mean, there's a very big increase here and drops, and people have studied the statistics of those fluctuations. Now, my talk isn't really about Arctic sea ice, but I did want to show you, unpack that plot a little bit and show you just how this field varies. This is a plot of the Arctic sea ice taken from a NASA website at the time of annual minimum extent. So it's around September each year after the peak insolation, after the peak sunlight period in the summer. And 95, 96, you saw there's a big increase, 97, okay, 98 was a warm year. And we see that this line has there's a lot of structure under this, but 2007 was really qualitatively different, and it was a surprise to see this drop. You know, there's this big swath of open ocean here. If we go to the next, let's see if I can get the cursor over, so we can go to the next year, and that's 2000. I'm going to 2008 here. So there was a recovery. I don't have 2009. So we can see that it came back, but the quality of the ice was different. It was thinner. When we talk about climate models and climate change, climate sensitivity, these kind of processes are what we have to try to understand. And they're very detailed and very hard to understand. People devote their lives just to studying the sea ice field. And we've had talks on that topic quite recently. But what I'm going to do is try to take a big picture view here, thinking about the models, the global predictions of the models, not so much focused on the regional details until the end, but acknowledging the fact that there's a lot we don't understand. I'll talk about some things we do understand, but really, one of the things we don't understand is how the climate system can surprise us. And this shows the same line I showed you before, the Arctic sea ice minimum extent, okay, up to 2007 and 8. And this envelope here, this gray envelope, shows the spread of predictions of current models of the same field. And this decline, really, you can find models where they see sharp declines, but it's not a common thing, and it really was a surprise. That 2007 drop was a genuine surprise. The stakes here, I don't have to belabor them, they're really high, you know, environmentally, politically. And so it's a really urgent job, in my view, to understand, you know, what is in this spread of models and how we can better constrain it and what observations are out there to understand it. And I'll talk about some progress in that. So the outline for today is to talk about the concepts of climate sensitivity, and I'll bring a bit of just standard global warming facts to you. And then I'll go into some very simple climate modeling ideas or climate theory ideas. This is kind of climate 101. Bring in a little bit of notation and very simple one-dimensional models to help understand how temperature responds to greenhouse gases. Then I'll get into the description of the models and how we can quantify climate sensitivity and break it apart into different parts. And then I will definitely, at the end, and probably in a bit of a rush, but I'll try to talk about the snow albedo feedback work that I've been doing here in Toronto. So this is very much a review talk, and the sources I've drawn from this are recent reviews, and there's been a lot of progress in characterizing climate sensitivity of the physical climate system, which consists of the atmosphere, oceans, sea ice, and so on. And this has been a very good prep ground for looking at biospheric effects, biology, biogeochemistry in the ocean, forests, and that kind of those systems, how they respond to climate will be incorporated in the next generation of models. But we have a good handle now in this literature. And I'm working with Brad Marston on a version of this kind of review that's supposed to be accessible for physicists. So we're going to send that to Review of Modern Physics in the next several months. Okay. So, I don't have to give the whole talk, except for the stuff at the end, which is the research part. If you have questions, just feel free to interrupt and ask. All right, just to set the stage, this is a plot of the carbon dioxide emissions, what we're sending up into the atmosphere. Taken from recent studies and updated from the NOAA website that deals with carbon dioxide emissions. This range of curves here this is a very pessimistic story. I'm sure several of you know this in the audience. It tells us the range of possible scenarios we thought, basically at this point in time, that the industrialized world would pursue. This was the worst case scenario, was the red. And if you look at 2006 and 2007, you can see, and going on in 2008, that we've outpaced the largest predictions of how much CO2 we'd emit. Of course, this might be a good news story if you're interested in economics, right? Because it's saying that the world is busy and producing lots of stuff, it's not all bad, but it's not an environmentally happy story. This is the result of all those emissions. The direct result is an increased greenhouse gas loading. This is the CO2 concentration. I don't know if you know this number, we're up at around 380 parts per million right now. This is updated this month from the Mauna Loa record, which was highlighted in Al Gore's movie. Okay, so what is that stuff doing? All right, well, the point of the global warming theory and idea is that we're contributing radiative forcing, we're causing an enhanced greenhouse effect, and that is warming the Earth. So this is a plot of the annual mean temperatures taken from surface land and ocean sites back from the 1880s, going up through. This is from the NASA, one of the NASA websites. This is 2008 here. It was a cold year relative to 2007. 2009 is coming back up to the long-term trend. The pattern of temperature, this is a temperature anomaly plot relative to the 51 to 1980 mean, so mid-century mean, of last century, showing this pattern of warming, and this is generally what you see: more warming at higher latitudes than lower latitudes, more warming in the northern hemisphere than the southern hemisphere. There's lots of ocean in the southern hemisphere that kind of drags the warming back. And this basic pattern is consistent, this fingerprint is consistent with what climate models are giving us. So this is a plot that involves no observations, this is just models. Actually, there are observations right at the beginning. So what I'm showing here is some of the well-known graphics from this IPCC report, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. This is the UN panel that assesses the state of climate science and the state of the climate system. And their report in 2007 produced these two figures. So this shows on the scale here, it's the year 1900 to 2300. The global surface warming, so the zero line here is, I believe, year 2000, but I could be wrong about that. It's a temperature difference. These are observations up to the time of the report. The gray shows the uncertainty in the observations, and the black is the mean of the observations themselves. And then you have a series of what are called forecast projections, scenarios, Under various assumptions of the radiative forcing. By radiative forcing, I mean the different type of emission scenarios that were forecast to take place, as I showed in a couple of slides ago. This yellow one here is a constant composition commitment. That means keeping the greenhouse gas concentrations fixed. And then we have a series of three, including this red one, which was the worst case. Okay, and you can see that there's lots of spread. So what I'm showing here in the shaded envelopes, that's the spread among the models. Okay, you can identify various sources of spread in this, but the uncertainty here is going forward. It's a forecast. So we can identify certain sources of spread. First of all, there's uncertainty in the forcings. And that's really, in this kind of picture, that's actually the largest source of uncertainty. What we are going to do next as a society, our political decisions will have a great deal of influence on the net outcome. I think that's worth realizing right away. But in terms of the physics of climate, right, there's uncertainties in how fast the system responds. That involves, basically, at a simple level, how fast the oceans can take up heat and the radiative excess that we're putting in the system and how fast that heat is let back into the system. So there's a timing issue that's coming from the oceans. But what I'm going to focus on today is the climate sensitivity. And that's really once the transient signal has finished in some theoretical future time, what's the net outcome once the system's equilibrated? So climate sensitivity is the equilibrium climate warming. And I'm going to be focusing here when I say atmosphere and cryosphere and ocean. I'm talking about the physical parts of the climate system, not the human plus biospheric parts. So all people are doing now is adding some CO2, let's say, and we want to see how the system responds to that in its physical components. This plot here shows the distribution of climate sensitivity in degrees and is a frequency distribution. And on the frequency axis is the number of models. So what is this climate sensitivity? Where did I get degrees from? Okay, the degrees is the amount of response you get in surface temperature per doubling of CO2. So some models say that if you double CO2 and just let the system equilibrate, you'll get a 2-degree increase. Some models say it's a much larger increase. You can see that the distribution is skewed to the right, and we'll mention that again briefly later once we understand a bit more about what goes into this curve. So there is a generic statement now that we have a mean climate sensitivity of about 3.5 degrees, 3.5, inferred from the models and from observational records. And there's a range, an uncertainty of 2 to 5 degrees and a long tail. That's the basic character of all these models. And the models themselves are quasi-independent. They are developed at different centers, like the one I used to work at. There's one in Canada. There are a few in the US. And all these models produce their own climate, their own character of the response to warming. So what I'm going to try to do is unpack that, that spread a little bit. OK, so here's the climate sensitivity parameter. It's, like I said verbally, it's the response of the surface temperature, T sub S, to a doubling of CO2, so log to the base 2 of carbon dioxide. So the change in temperature per, and this is on a global average, all right? And the R here, it's what you keep fixed. So there's going to be a little bit of partial derivatives, as in thermodynamics or other courses you might have taken. So this is for fixed net radiation absorbed. So we're talking about an equilibrated system here. We change the composition, allow the system to equilibrate, and find this quantity. And this is just to say that the radiative equilibrium we're talking about here is a balance between incoming sunlight, shortwave radiation, and emitted terrestrial radiation. And that's what we'll talk about right now. Okay, so this is your Climate 101 class. And I have lots of references to pass to you if you're interested. This is a good one if you want to talk to your great uncle about climate change. It's by David Archer, Understanding the Forecast. It's very good. It's fairly technical, but not too heavy. So it's a good one just to read as background. Okay, so the big picture here is to understand terrestrial climate. You need to know about the radiation coming in and the radiation going out. We've got a shortwave here, and from ultraviolet to visible to near infrared coming from the sun. The Earth's terrestrial radiation emitted in the long wave. So we have from near infrared to long wave. So you get basically radiation at several hundred nanometers coming in and emitting at a few microns. We look at the to understand what the energy balance on the Earth. We can look at pictures from space. This is very well characterized. Okay, we can look, this is for a particular month this year. This is the shortwave absorbed by the atmosphere. You can see it's dark at the pole because there was no insulation there. And we've got cloud patterns and so on that I'll talk about more next. The long wave emitted it's a smoother distribution than the short wave. The scale here goes basically from 0 to 430, and from here it goes from 130 to 315. So there's actually a weak gradient in the long wave because the temperature gradient, because this is related to the temperature gradient, and this is more related to the incoming sunlight, which is just involved as the angle of incidence of that sunlight. So what's really tied into the radiative balance of the Earth is the distribution of clouds, and that's a key source of uncertainty in climate modeling. So this is just a picture. You've probably seen these kind of pictures before, showing it's basically often just interpreted as a cloud map, but it's actually the emitted long-wave radiation color-coded to match our picture of what's happening visually. So these bright areas, these are high clouds, okay? This is cold areas, actually. So the white colors here are cold. The blue colors here are warmer. These patterns, you can see the clouds are just basically giving you themselves the IR field just at a glance, okay? Now, I've been really trying to bridge gaps in this department. This is the one joke, so I hope you're going to laugh. See, you've already laughed. That's great. Okay, so I told this joke at Stanford, and they didn't laugh. Okay. So anyway, all right. So you know, we have talk after talk on accelerators and LHC and stuff, and I thought, okay, well, this is great. Let's talk about everything in terms of units of LHC power. Wouldn't that be great? So okay, so the LHC, the beam energy of the LHC is 700 megajoules. I looked that up. Is that right, Bob? There. See? I don't know, is that both beams or one? Anyway, that's a lot of energy. Okay, so here's our humble little infrared photon with its energy of 0.3 electron volts. So, is this going to be a good measure for terrestrial radiation? I don't think so. It's 7 × 10⁻²⁹ LHC. So it's pretty wimpy. There's not really much to it. In terms of watts per meter squared, what we see basically a couple of light bulbs of infrared energy that we can pick up per watt per meter squared. So this should be 0.3. This is micro LHC per meter squared second. Still not a very good unit. Total infrared radiance, if you add up all the infrared radiation, 10 to the 11 megawatts, that's 200 mega LHCs per second. So that's, you know, it's starting to get pretty good. So we're not going to use the LHC much more than this. But what I will talk about is the what you're actually seeing here are sources of emission of long-wave radiation. These blue patches are clear sky. That means you're seeing the emission from the surface. That's a lot of those are strongly radiating surfaces that emit right to space. The high clouds here are up at 8 to 12 kilometers. They're emitting to space at that level. The low clouds are also emitting at 0.3 kilometers or so. Okay, so those are low clouds, and those have a relatively minor impact on long-wave radiation. So the point I want to make with this slide is just to show how at every day you look, you have a shortwave effect and a long-wave effect of the clouds, and they trace each other perfectly. So there's this dual role that clouds play that you might have heard of. They can act as reflecting surfaces for shortwave radiation coming in, and they act as blankets trapping the radiation, the long-wave radiation. And so the emitted long-wave radiation, say in this snapshot, is at a minimum just where the cloud is reflecting the most sunlight. And if you just animate that, you can see that kind of behavior just happening at every day. So this is daily radiation. Well, let me just move it along. And you can just see those things being perfectly anti-correlated all the time. Ah, I went to the back. There we go. That's what I wanted to show you. Okay, so you can see that the weather and the cloud impacts are all mixed up together, and they're very hard to disentangle. Okay, so that's a general picture of what's going on radiatively in the Earth. Let's talk about some very simple theory. So the very simplest model for talking about the Earth's temperature is talking about the skin temperature, so-called, or the emission temperature. So we have terrestrial radiation going out at about 4 microns, and shortwave incoming solar radiation, which is called insolation, at about 600 nanometers. And these two things should be in radiative balance, okay? So you have you translate everything into watts per meter squared, so you're talking about the average, even the annual average radiative balance. And the very simple theory goes like this, that if the system is in radiative balance, the short and long wave net fluxes should balance. And the long wave, just through Stefan Boltzmann, should be sigma t to the fourth times some emissivity, which we can just say is 1 for now. And this t to the, what temperature is it? So we can relate the short wave and long wave to some temperature, T sub E. Okay, the short wave we know, that's coming, that's constrained from the sun, that's coming in about 240 watts per meter squared. T sub E is about 255 Kelvin. Okay, that's called the emission temperature, and it's just S over sigma to the 1/4 power. Now, if we look back at this picture here of the clouds and their emissions of photons to space, you can see that there's a distribution of levels of emission, all right? But on average, there's a characteristic level, and one way of identifying that characteristic level is to ask, well, at the point where T is equal to T sub E, how high is that if you look out at the atmosphere? And it turns out to be about 5 kilometers. So you can think of that as the average height of a photon being emitted to space. Okay, so T is equal to T sub E at about 5 kilometers. And if we look now at the surface temperature, we know that the surface temperature is not 255 Kelvin. Anybody know what it is? I probably wrote it on the slide there. What's the average surface temperature of the Earth? About 15, okay? So 255 is about minus 15 or so, minus 18. So actually, the difference between the surface temperature and the emission temperature is 33 degrees. Okay, so to explain that, we invoke the greenhouse effect. All right, and the greenhouse effect is giving you that back radiation from the. So looking from space, you just see the radiation coming up, but of course at the surface, if we could see the infrared coming down, what we would see is the back radiation that warms up the surface. So to really understand surface temperature and how global warming is related to atmosphere composition, we need to at least go to a layer model, or what I prefer is a one-dimensional model. And I've added a couple of parameters here. So we have L, which is the long wave radiation out. The short wave radiation coming in is the same. And this represents the emission level and the emission temperature. So this is the height at which the short wave and long wave balance. And this is the height at which the corresponding temperature corresponds to the incoming short wave. All right, I'm going to put in a temperature profile here. The temperature is typically observed to decrease with height in the atmosphere, and the rate at which it does that is called the lapse rate, which is defined in this way as the negative derivative of temperature. And another parameter in this little model will be the greenhouse gas optical thickness. Okay, so how much absorber there is, which is tau. Okay, if we put a little bit of greenhouse gas and that's able to absorb the long-wave radiation, we find the following two results. And this is just using radiative transfer theory or numerical models of that. Basically, there's two things that happen. First of all, you generate a lapse rate if you have some sort of greenhouse gas in there. And you also generate a surface temperature jump. So this T of Z equals 0 is the extrapolation to Z equals 0 of this profile. And what this equation here tells you is that if tau is positive, all right, then there is some finite difference between this temperature here in the interior and the surface temperature. The surface temperature is always going to be warmer, and there'll be a discontinuity according to the radiative transfer equations. This equation here tells you that the optical thickness, the larger it is, this is a monotonically this is an increasing function of thickness. The so-called radiative lapse rate, which is the lapse rate that results just from straight radiative transfer, is increasing the optical thickness. Now, I want to make a point about this that is not directly related to radiation, but it's more about hydrodynamics. And the point is that both of these effects, the temperature jump at the surface and the fact that the lapse rate increases more as you add more tracer, means that you have sources of instability. So that at some point, almost right away in this, you have to bring in the behavior of fluids under temperature gradients. So this is unstable inherently. And if you make the atmosphere thick enough in the interior of the atmosphere, what happens is you get colder and colder temperatures as you go higher, denser air over lighter air, and it becomes convectively unstable. So there's a limit at which tau is great enough to destabilize the fluid. And so what we have to do to understand climate better is to really think about these kind of convective sources and how the atmosphere really responds to concentrations of greenhouse gases that are there. So I'm just going to really briefly talk about circulation, which is really what I like to think about. Take a little break and look at the nice pictures. Okay, this is another infrared image, which Mike Wallace, who was here a few years ago for the Nobel Lectures, presented as in his presentations. And it shows, it's focused on the tropics, so it's a geostationary image. And the flashing here is the diurnal variation of radiation. So you can see a day happening every second or two. Okay, and this figure shows this large area of convection actually moving to the right. This is something called the Madden-Julian oscillation. But what I wanted to do highlight in this, besides the fact that it's a really beautiful picture, is to show you that there's qualitative differences between the types of circulations you get in the tropics and the extratropics. Okay, in the tropics, everything's vertically organized, radially organized, coming out of them. And there's lots and lots of scales. Okay, and if you dig into the theory a little bit, you'll see that everything's vertically, there's vertical transports relieving that temperature gradient vertically. And everything is really tied to moisture. Moisture is setting up everything in kind of vertical columns. That's the way we understand the tropics. The extratropics is really different. It's a much more rotational. You can see these systems being spun off and kind of spiraling out, okay, in the two hemispheres. Extratropical fluid dynamics, what sets the temperature structure there is going to involve much more lateral motions, the effects of rotation, and a whole different type of fluid dynamics and turbulence. Okay, we call these kind of turbulence macro turbulence on the large scale, and there's a really clean separation between these two, and what really determines it is the effects of rotation. So, to really understand what's going on with the lapse rate, with the temperature structure, you have to really dig in. It's complicated. Okay. But what we're going to do is just assume a lapse rate, and the lapse rate is going to be something that we'll assume and watch what happens if we keep it fixed. So the question now is, what happens with the surface temperature as we add more CO2? Okay, so what we're going to do is add CO2, say double it, and keep the lapse rate fixed, and we're going to keep the insulation fixed. So my question is, and you have to answer quick because I'm going to run out of time, is what would happen to the emission temperature if I did that? And no atmospheric physics people can answer this question. So I'm going to double CO2. What's going to happen to the emission temperature? Daniel! What did you know? Anybody say? Okay. The emission temperature goes down? Nothing. Yes, nothing happens. Okay? Nothing! Thank you. Gold star. For Ephraim. So nothing happens because the emission temperature is exactly the temperature that gives you a balance with the incoming radiation. Okay? So what happens when you add more CO2 is not that the emission temperature changes, but it's the emission level that changes. Okay? It was just more a question of the definitions I've used. So what happens to the emission level is, as you thicken the atmosphere, the emission level goes up. And if we assume that the lapse rate is fixed, which is a big assumption, but I can justify a little later, or talk about it a little later, the whole profile shifts over to maintain that radiative balance. Okay? So when we double CO2, it turns out that we raise that emission level by about 100 meters. Doesn't sound like very much, and it really isn't. Doubling CO2 by itself only changes the atmospheric temperature, the surface temperature, by about a degree or so. So it's not a huge change in absence of any feedbacks. Okay. So let's calculate the change in temperature. And what I'm going to do is just use a very simple algebraic way of talking about the radiation balance at the top. So the radiation has long wave and short wave, and it's a function of temperature, of lapse rate, of the greenhouse gas concentrations of water vapor, clouds, ice, vegetation, all sorts of things. And we're going to assume that we're in a system where that's constrained to be zero. And we're going to imagine a variation where we change the CO2 concentration, okay, up here, and we're going to see how the surface temperature responds. So we can actually realize that experiment. And, you know, people say, oh, this is undoable or something, to talk about these these kind of calculations are only things you can do in computers. But actually, it's a physically, in principle, realizable thing to do. And under the effects, under a constraint of radiative equilibrium, The change in R, which should be zero, the variation, involves a variation in temperature and a variation in CO2 times these two partial derivatives. Okay? So if this linearization is valid, with this assumption being held, okay, what we have is that the change in temperature is the product of these partials times the change in CO2, and the product of these partials is the thing we're looking for, which is the rate of change of temperature with respect to a doubling of CO2 times the change of CO2. Okay, so now we can calculate this. We can calculate the change in change in radiation per degree. Here it's 4 watts per meter squared Kelvin. That's just Stefan Boltzmann. From radiative transfer codes, you can calculate, and this is all backed up by lots and lots of testing and theory. You can calculate the change in long wave at the top of the atmosphere for a doubling of CO2, and that gives you minus 4 watts per meter squared. And as I said, the climate sensitivity, the reference sensitivity, which I'm going to call delta naught, is the ratio of these two quantities with a minus sign, and that gives you 1 Kelvin. So the basic reference climate sensitivity of 1 Kelvin is what comes out of allowing CO2 to vary and keeping everything else fixed. And that's where we start. And that 1 degree per doubling is not a big number. That's a number that every time we doubled CO2, we got a degree, we could handle that. Where climate gets interesting, both to study and to understand for its implications, is the idea that feedbacks are amplifying the signal. So a feedback is in anything that is involves a quantity that's both affected by surface temperature and is radiatively important. So, for example, for water vapor, that's the key feedback I'll talk about. Water vapor is a powerful greenhouse gas, and the distribution of water vapor depends very much on temperature. Okay, the warmer your system, the more water vapor it can hold in principle. So now let's just vary this very simple model and allow, so we have a variation of CO2, we have a variation in temperature, and because water vapor in my very simple model is tied directly to temperature, okay, whatever its dependence is, that's what's going to come into the feedback analysis. So how does water vapor feedback come in? Well, you just do those same partial derivatives again. It's a very simple exercise to show that the sensitivity doubling of CO2, now with radiative equilibrium, and this E represents everything that isn't accounted for in this expression, plus water vapor, everything else, okay, which is plenty, of course, right? But if we allow just for water vapor to vary, allow that functional dependence between water vapor and temperature to be stuck in there, then we get delta naught divided by this 1 minus GH2O, where G is just a feedback factor. It's just standard feedback analysis. But I want to unpack it a little bit. Just say, this involves three things. It involves the change of water vapor with respect to temperature, which is really our theory of thermodynamics and circulation. How does water vapor change when you change temperature? This part comes from radiative transfer. This is the very simple part, really. This is the hard part, this is simple, and this is also simple, this is just Stefan Boltzmann again, okay? So if there's uncertainty in the water vapor feedback, it's really coming from how water vapor responds to changes in temperature. And that's a question, as I tried to show visually, that's a question of circulation and thermodynamics and needs a lot of thought. But we actually have a pretty good handle on this number, on this G sub H2O, this feedback factor, okay? If it were a negative number, then there would be negative feedback, which would mean that global warming would be attenuated by the water vapor feedback. No feedback, it would be zero. If it was a positive feedback, it's positive. It would make this denominator smaller. The estimated greenhouse effect of water vapor gives you 0.4. Okay, so that's a pretty big number compared to 1. That brings 1 down to 0.6. And of course, if you were looking for a runaway effect, it would be a number greater than 1. All within this linearization. So the basic fact is that as we look across water vapor, across the models and observations, and try to our best to characterize it, the number we're seeming to settle on is about 0.4 with uncertainty attached to it. And that 0.4 gives you a climate sensitivity that goes from 1 degree up to 1.7 degrees. So the game at this point is to add other effects and make the whole thing more and more realistic. So we add a feedback involving the lapse rate, a feedback involving clouds, ice, and so on. And I'll get to how we quantify that a little later. The main message, though, is that these feedbacks are, in general, positive, unfortunately. All these numbers are positive, which means that they tend to give you an answer of climate sensitivity that's boosted up from 2, from 1 degree to 1.7 to 3, and in some cases even higher, depending on the model. And in this formalism, I just wanted to hopefully convince you that the formalism is actually pretty simple, and you could imagine how to add other things, add biospheric effects and so on. But what we really need to do to understand, this is just a simple toy approach, right? So what I'm going to tell you is that we can make the leap to current climate models pretty easily in these feedbacks. So I'm going to skip one slide and just say that the observations are very difficult quantities. It's very difficult to look at observations and understand what climate sensitivity is. And the reason is that all those things I held fixed mathematically, when you go out in the field and observe, okay, they're not held fixed, right? And this is where we really lean heavily on the models. The way we test the models against observations is to find processes that are really relevant to climate feedbacks. For example, the relationship between temperature and cloud structure, or temperature, surface temperature and precipitation. We try to make sure the models are getting the weather right, are doing all these other, getting El Nino right, and all that kind of stuff. And when we do that, we see a mixture of results, of course. This is a good one. These are two good ones. I'll show you a bad one later. This shows how water vapor that's observed is basically captured by the models as long as we give the models the observed ocean surface conditions. This shows how the models capture the basic effects of greenhouse trapping under the influence of El Nino. So the models can, for some basic tests and increasingly sophisticated tests, are getting better at this. But what I really wanted to talk about is how, and I'll skip that slide, is how we can use those very simple ideas that I've developed over here, okay, and translate them into this world of models. And right now in this field, it's very exciting because the models that are available are much more accessible, much better documented, and much easier to analyze than they've been at all, ever been. And this allows people to really, really dig in and see what the different models are doing and what's consistent with nature and what isn't. So as an example, let's say I wanted to understand just this quantity, which is the way radiation responds to changes in water vapor. You can translate this into a much more thorough quantity that will really tell you a lot more about the physics involved. So what I'm showing here is just an expression for how to analyze a model's water vapor response at the top of the atmosphere, the radiative response to a change in water vapor at each level. So for example, if I increase the water vapor by, say, 1% here in this particular climate model, and there are no clouds, then that will give rise to a change in radiation at the top of the atmosphere of about 0.2 watts per meter squared. So this vertical distribution tells you where the important photons are, I guess, or where the important parts of the atmosphere are for understanding how the greenhouse trapping is affected by changes in water vapor. And you can see, so this is just the kernel of the calculation that gives you the climate sensitivity, but it's very important. And you can see, for example, that if you assume that clouds aren't important, you're dead wrong. Because this is a calculation done with no clouds, and this is a calculation done with all the whole cloud field. And you can see that the effect of clouds is to basically mask the greenhouse trapping coming from the lower atmosphere and put all the big effects in the greenhouse trapping in the driest regions of the atmosphere, up in the upper troposphere, where it's very hard to measure water vapor. And this is the key place. This is the place where there's a lot of controversy. Climate debate about just what water vapor is doing to the climate system. So you can see clouds have this profound effect, and this is a new calculation, 2008. I mean, I want you to appreciate that this is something that just couldn't be done. And what people are doing now is doing this with model after model after model and going to the observations and seeing which ones are reasonable. So that was the kind of kernel of the climate feedback calculation. Now what happens when we put everything together We integrate over that picture. I didn't really explain it very well. This picture is a function of latitude and pressure, okay? So height, altitude. So this is a latitude and altitude picture taking the longitudinal mean of this what's called the radiative kernel. So when you do that, and then you multiply by the actual change in, so this is just the change in water vapor, radiation for change in water vapor, then you can multiply this kernel by the change in water vapor per change in temperature and integrate that, and that gives you the climate sensitivity. So this is what's been done for these IPCC models, the UN models. And it's been done with several different radiative transfer codes, and those don't make a difference. So there's actually a lot of information in this. But what they're showing here is the effects of water vapor changes, lapse rate changes, the sum of those two, surface albedo changes, and cloud changes. Okay. So from this, one of the things that's... So this is the water vapor feedback we've talked about. This gives you what I was calling, it's in different units, it's in watts per meter squared instead of degrees. But you can see that the water vapor feedback is the strongest feedback in the climate system. And all the models agree on that. And the models are being closely compared with observations to make sure that that makes sense. The lapse rate feedback is actually closely tied to the water vapor feedback. In fact, it's a negative feedback, and it relates to the change in the change in the temperature structure that happens when you warm the system and increase water vapor. And what this, when you add up, when you include both those feedbacks together, you can see that this spread among the models, the spread this way is among the models, is greatly reduced because these guys are anti-correlated. So models with strong water vapor feedback have strong negative lapse rate feedback. So when you include those feedbacks together, it doesn't make sense to separate them, then you get this. So this is water vapor plus lapse rate, which is a weaker feedback. And this is well known. This is not a surprise at all. The albedo feedback is I'll talk about when we get to snow. I'll spend a couple minutes on that. The cloud feedback has always been the real uncertainty. And for a long time, papers disagreed with each other as to the importance of the cloud feedback. And it's only now that people have gotten really careful about how to do the linearizations and how to go through the model systematically that we have this much of a convergence of an answer. And this shows that the cloud feedbacks are still very uncertain compared to other things. I would really like to see them start combining these cloud estimates with the other moist variables. But for now, we just look at the clouds separately. And on average, they represent a positive forcing. So what that's saying is that the greenhouse trapping effect of clouds is, on average, winning out. But it's still a big source of uncertainty. Okay. Now, I started near the beginning with this distribution of climate sensitivities. And people realize now why the skew is so strong. And that is because the skew involves... that climate sensitivity itself is one a number divided by one minus a series of other numbers, and each of those other numbers is basically normally distributed. So what you're seeing in this skew is just the fact that you're taking the ratio of a series. You're taking the reciprocal of a series of numbers that are normally distributed, and that's giving you this long tail. So what people are saying now is that this climate sensitivity is actually a very robustly skewed to the right, and it's not going to get much better as models get realistic, because there's always the potential for outliers in your feedback factors to skew you to the right. Okay, so this takes me to my research. Okay, so I don't do research on the fundamentals of climate sensitivity. What I've always been interested in, and I tried to emphasize it a couple times here, is circulation responses. And I'm working with my postdoc Chris Fletcher on this, and Alex Hall and Shin Chu from UCLA have looked a lot at how the snow albedo feedback works in models and observations. And this is a nice story because it tells us about how a part of the climate system that we actually understand relatively well is represented and misrepresented in models. So snow albedo feedbacks, this is the simplest feedback to understand because it's a brightness effect. When you melt snow or sea ice, it exposes either darker ground, typically, or ocean, which has a low albedo. Okay, so you're exposing a darker surface and thereby enhancing the amount of shortwave light absorbed in the system. So if you look at this feedback factor here, just to make sure we have the notation, I is ice, okay? So that when you warm the system, you get less ice. So that term is negative. The term up here is the effect on radiation of reducing the ice, okay? So when you make it when you make it less white, you get less shortwave. This gives you a positive number in our notation. And then this number here is the increase in terrestrial radiation for change in temperature. So you have positive, positive, negative, multiplied by minus, and that gives you positive. All right. So the snow albedo feedback is positive, and that has always that has been long, long known. You can actually try to quantify the feedback in different ways, and I really like this picture, so I'm going to insist on showing it to you. It's taken from a study from Alex Hall, who took a climate model which had oceans and snow and all the stuff, dirty stuff that climate models have. And what he was able to do with the model is go in and tell the shortwave radiative transfer code that the albedo was fixed. No matter what, the albedo would just stay what it was in a certain run. And then he added CO2 and allowed the model to warm up. And the snow got the snow went away and all that. But in this model, there was no feedback allowed because the shortwave radiation was always seeing the same albedo in this second run. And turning off, suppressing the snow albedo feedback, SIF, actually really reduced the amount of warming you had, and particularly at high latitudes. So this kind of study is what goes into our conclusion that high latitude climate change is going to happen faster than the rest of the world. We'll have bigger reductions in sea ice. All those things, they're quantified in this kind of study. Now, I said that we see, I showed you a picture of the albedo field from space. It's something that's actually pretty well characterized. How do models represent the albedo? Well, Hall and others have shown that if you look at observations and you look at the models, and you can actually quantify snow albedo feedback just in looking at the seasonal cycle, which is interesting too, it turns out that the models really have a huge spread, okay, in the way they represent how bright snow is. Some models show the snow field is very dark, and some show it is very bright. And the really bright models are the ones with strong snow albedo feedback, because the feedback operates on the contrast between the really bright stuff and the dark ground. So here are the observations. The models are all spread out. The consequence of that is that there's a spread among all the models that are used. You can see there's a dozen and a half or so models between models with weak snow albedo feedback and strong. There's about a factor of 3 between them. And what Hall and others have done, and what we're feeding off of, is the fact that if you look at the models that have the strongest snow albedo feedback, you can look at, this is the pattern of warming in those models. This is a map of the temperature response to climate change, basically correlated with this, with an index based on this spread. The message from this is that models that have a lot of snow albedo feedback, they warm more in North America, a bit more in Eurasia. They also warm more over the ocean. And the fact that there was an ocean signature to this stimulated Chris Fletcher, actually, to say, well, there might be something dynamical here, which means that there's a remote signal. It's not really downwind of anything, it's actually upwind. And why is that signal there? So we dug in a bit, and we were thinking of actually El Nino, okay? Not for the literal fact that El Nino is forcing the same way snow is, that wasn't it. El Nino involves temperatures in the ocean and the tropical Pacific, and these stimulate stream flow patterns that extend basically worldwide. You see these characteristic patterns of variability and response to tropical Pacific temperatures all over the world. So those kind of teleconnections, we call them, led us to think there might be a teleconnection signal associated with snow albedo feedback that the models might be giving consistently. So in this little study, what we did was took that same approach of asking which models have strong snow albedo feedback, which have weak albedo feedback, and compositing that against temperature, soil moisture, but also sea level pressure. And you can see that the models with strong snow albedo feedback have a consistent sea level pressure response, and that's basically surface circulation, sea level pressure. So this positive number here means that you have a circulation this way in the North Pacific and in the North Atlantic. And it turns out that the models have quite a bit of spread in their predictions of how sea level pressure will change under climate change. So the idea here is that even though snow albedo feedback is only happening over land, it's having global consequences. It's even having consequences over the oceans, and that is the way the surface winds respond will help, also determines how the oceans respond to climate change. This is a picture of the vertical structure, and there's actually a wave structure buried in this as well. So understanding this dynamically is something that's really interesting. Okay, so, I got to talk about the research a little bit. All right, so just to finish off, it's a bit of a whirlwind tour, and I hope I didn't bore you with too much basic stuff. So what do we have? Well, we have a bunch of models that do not agree. There's a 2 to 5 degree range in the spread, spread in the range of predictions to climate change. What I've tried to tell you is that we've made a lot of progress in characterizing what causes that spread. Figuring out what about the clouds is causing the uncertainty? What about water vapor feedback? What about snow albedo feedback? And at every step of the way, we can ask, well, what can we compare to observations? And the fact that we're doing this now is really predicated on the existence of huge databases and huge data sets that have been created by basically a cooperative scientific effort. These groups are competing to generate climate data, climate output for them from their models, but they're also agreeing to cooperate, put it together, and let the world look at these these outputs and come to some sort of idea based on simple theory, and then more in-depth analysis with comparison with observations to make progress on this. So what I'd say is that now that we're adding more and more to these models, biospheric effects and so on, and we're in a much better position now than we were even 5 years ago to understand how the effects of, say, carbon cycle and other feedback effects will figure into the climate system. And with that, I'll finish.